the also the university archivist. And so about the time I was finishing my degree, he had a job in the archives and no one to fill it. And so he asked me to take the job in the university archives. And so for about 2.5 years I've worked there.
He has instructed the secretary, no matter how busy I am, I don't care if it's a $10 million deal, any of my family calls.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And you, I mean, never use it. I get fewer calls, I guess. No. I don't mean just my wife, I mean my children, my grandchildren, anyway.
Well, just for the record, this is an oral history interview with Mr. Sam Klein. Today's August 9th, 1977, and my name is Dwayne Cox. I'm from the University of Louisville. And this is one interview in a series of interviews that was begun in March of this year in cooperation between the University of Louisville Archives and the Jewish Community Federation, a cooperative effort to record an oral history of the oral autobiographies of some of the influential people in the Jewish community in Louisville. Mr. Klein is a banker associated with the Bank of Louisville. He's a native of Louisville, grew up here, went to school at Mayo High School, attended the University of Louisville for a time, and has served on many civic boards, community service projects, and today I was hoping that we could talk some about his life, about his childhood, about his parents, about his earliest recollections of Louisville, about his work in the used car business and in the banking business in Louisville, and with various civic organizations. And like I said in my letter to you, I guess historians are sort of locked into taking things in chronological order sometime, and that has advantages and disadvantages. But a good place to start maybe is with your parents, who they were, where they came from. Were they born in Louisville? What are your recollections of the neighborhood where you grew up?
Well, of course, as you said, I was born in Louisville, and my parents were not. I don't know that I recall where my father was born. I know my mother was born in Riga, R-I-G-A. I think that's the capital of Latvia. I think I was told that when she was raised up there, it was under the German jurisdiction. I think sometimes Russia had it and sometimes uh-huh. Germany had it. I think they came to this the United States about 100 years ago. Somewhere over 100 years ago. I was born 8th of St. Catherine, but I was told that when I was 3 months old, we moved to the place I first remember, and that was the first in Green Street. Now, Green Street now is called Liberty Street. My folks were very, very poor. They had one of those small grocery stores. I mean, very small. Taking $10 or $15 a day while they were doing pretty well. That's sort of a situation. We lived upstairs above the store.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very not only poor neighborhood, but probably one of the worst neighborhoods that the city of Louisville had. There were four saloons, on the four corners that first you read. And a block away from that, you had First and Jefferson, and then you had the Haymarket situation all around there. It was really a hodgepodge of people. On the corner, on the southeast corner of that particular saloon, saloon was on the corner. We lived next door to the saloon, and next door to that was some other sort of a shop. Then there were some Italian people who lived next door to them, and there were some blacks next to them. And then there were some Syrians next to them, and there'd be some more blacks and some more Italians. And I think there was one other Jewish family on the block that I recall. And then there were some more black Italians, so on and so forth. Across the street from where I live, there was a Jewish family across there, had a dry goods store. First time I thought of that for me. You know, one fellow had a cleaning pressing place, and they had some Italian people. Then they had the neighborhood house. And this was a playground subsidized by the city of Louisville. More Italians. Just the way the whole block was. And the drugstore on the corner first of all. We lived there until I was about 10 years old, and then we moved on the same block across the street, up a little closer to Warren Street, near what we call Prospect Alley in those days. It was where the interurban cars would go through. The interurban cars, which had their main station on 3rd Street, between Wall and Liberty, pretty much where the Starks were. The Starks garage is right. And we had the same old grocery store. We lived upstairs above it. And then after about, maybe I was about 15 years old, we moved over to a house on Clay Street that my father had bought years ago, rented out and paid for itself. And it was divided up into four apartments, and we lived on one. The other three were leased out. The elementary school, I went to George W. Morris School at Boyd's Heston. And then from there, of course, we went to Logan Yale High School at Brooklyn Beckley School.
So you were born in 1906, and so you're talking about the neighborhood around First and what was then Green Street.
First and Green Street.
During the 19-teens.
Yes.
Was that a part of the?
I guess almost up to the 20s.
Yeah. The 19-teens.
Moves away. 20s. Teens. Yeah.
Was that? I know that where the U of L Medical School is now, I think was around in that area was considered to be a Jewish neighborhood. Was the area where you lived? It didn't sound like it. It sounded like it was where you lived was a multinational sort of neighborhood.
The university was at First and Chestnut.
I mean, where the new medical school is now.
The new medical school.
Right.
Well.
Down at
Preston. Now you're getting. Don't forget, in those days, you were on that block, and that's about as far as you went. I mean, you didn't go four or five blocks away. Preston Street, yes. Preston Street was the Jewish center, you might say.
Yeah.
I mean, this is where the practically all the stores and were all practically all Jewish people, with few exceptions. And that went all the way from I guess, all the way from Market, Main, close to Main, I guess, Market Street all the way on down, I guess, from Broadway, maybe Chestnut. They were, you had, yes, you had some Jewish families all in this first there at where the hospital was, of course, and all around there, around Chestnut Street, Wallace Street, but just for a few blocks.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a few blocks east, maybe towards Jackson.
Mm-hmm.
I think when you got past Jackson, when you had non-Jews, general rule, back in those days, there wasn't that many.
Uh-huh.
When you take consideration that today, there's probably 2,500 Jewish families in Louisville. That's all you have,
mm-hmm.
2,500. In those days, maybe, well, if you had 600 or 700 families, I guess 800 families, you had a whole lot.
Mm-hmm.
So you didn't you didn't have too much territory to cover. Madison Street was where the hospital is, was practically all Jewish, between Brook and Floyd.
Mm-hmm.
But then when you get past Floyd, well, then it's sort of more non-Jews to Jews. You see, I mean, you couldn't go very far away. Of course, up to Preston, when you got to Preston, you had some around in there. But when you got to Jackson, you didn't have any more.
Mm-hmm.
Because don't forget, you had some blacks
yeah.
around Jackson, Hancock.
What do you remember about your childhood? Were your parents religious?
Oh, yes.
Did you work in your father's store?
Oh, yes.
Who
yes.
came in the store? Was it a neighborhood store?
Yeah, well, that was a small store. Blacks and whites. Blacks and whites. And like I say, the whites were Italians. It's mostly foreigners.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't much of a store, but you know, it's a place to where you got to live in.
Did you have any formal religious training as a youngster? Did you go
formal.
To a, did you go to a
I was confirmed, but that was it. Like all youngsters in the village.
You didn't go to a predecessor of what I guess they would be called the Hebrew school.
Sorry, it wasn't the Hebrew school. The Hebrew school was on Walnut Street. Between Brook and Floyd, near Brook, where it was a local Hebrew school. No, we went to a fellow who instructed the youngsters, and actually he was a kind of a fellow, I think the only one who would get you by, but I'm sorry. Learned to read the Hebrew characters, very well. He didn't teach us the meaning of it, so I never did learn Hebrew because he never really taught us the translations, like you would get if you went to Hebrew school. Now there you would learn to understand Hebrew, so I never gained that. I knew very little Hebrew, just the words you pick up. I think the only one I know now is Shalom.
Mm-hmm.
You know what it means,
yeah.
Don't you? You hear that all the time. When I was a very, very youngster, I attended services with my father. Religious services at the synagogue, which was between not too far from where we live, on the next block.
Mm-hmm.
It was on first between Walnut and Chestnut, but near Walnut.
Mm-hmm.
And two or three doors from there, when I was a youngster, it was the old YMHA building,
mm-hmm.
which later moved over to Second and Jacob.
Did you go to the YMHA?
very rarely. I can't recall going to the one on First Street very long, because I was a youngster. Very often. I'm sure I was in there, but I don't recall anybody. The First and Jacob, I went there. I faintly recall belonging to some group club, youngsters, that we meet on Sunday or something. And then I became a member of it because I know I used to always stop by when I got off of work and take my shies there. Got in the habit of almost taking a shower there. I didn't participate in any athletics there at all. The only athletics I participated with all was the neighborhood house.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that stuff?
Oh, sure. House? Oh, I used to live there.
Yeah.
It was right across the street from where we lived. We lived there first in Green. And then when we moved across the street, we were just two or three doors away from the team. It was great. They had a playground that would open during the... that were closed during the winter time. I think later on when I was getting away from it, I think the Belknaps got a house next door and have something now where they have, I imagine they have something there now inside too. But at the time I was, it was mostly a spring, summer, fall deal.
Mm-hmm.
I had to play it every day. There was a nice little playground. Played everything possible for a child to play. Baseball, football, basketball. They had a nice gymnasium.
Mm-hmm.
They built a nice gymnasium. Volleyball, running, jumping, pole vaulting, almost anything you can think of. And they'd have some cultural projects from time to time. The gymnasium was sort of like an auditorium,
mm-hmm.
a stage there. I imagine it's still there today, but it's in the years. And so there were culture programs which they got to do, and it was organized very well. They had games to play and things to do, up to, you know, your certain age levels. I think it's probably wonderful thing for a wonderful place for our youngsters to grow up. Unfortunately, a lot of the men, fellows that I played with didn't turn out so good. Even while they were at the neighborhood house,
mm-hmm.
some of them would be arrested for stealing and nothing like you have today. I mean, but once in a while you'd have an exception. They turned out the wrong way.
Were there any of them who grew up to be heads of banks?
Wait a minute now, I'm sorry to say, but by the same token, some of them turned out to be great. I don't know if anyone else turned out to be head of a bank. I know that some of them have turned out to be great citizens. I think some of them, of course, have moved away to other cities. I just haven't had any contact. I don't know what happened to them. Some of them are still in Louisville. I used to see on the street from time to time. Very rare. And I enjoy seeing them. I go out of my way to try to find some of them and to talk to them. Is a neighbor house still there?
I'm not sure. This was the thing.
I know they have a neighbor house.
Yeah.
I know I send contributions to the neighborhood house, but I thought they were in the West End there on Bank Street or something.
Yeah.
Along. So I don't know what they still have. They may still have a downtown, I'm not sure. I can say this. It gave the youngsters an opportunity, boys and girls. And I wasn't only boys, I understand, boys and girls. It gave the youngsters an opportunity to be occupied, to learn things, and they did try to teach you things, which were good. And I had to turn out very successful. I can't very well say that because of neighborhood house I was successful, mm-hmm. but it certainly helped. They tried to shape me up. Yeah. They tried to teach me the right things to do. And I'd say that most of the youngsters are good at that. It was a good deal. Of course, you can always remember the people that went bad, or the people did extra good. I'm sure that 90% of them were good average citizens and remained that way. First time I've ever been asked to talk about the neighborhood house. Outside of just having wonderful times there, enjoying it. Of course, then you get to be about 15 years old, and you break away from that.
Yeah. Did you get your first job about then, about the time you began to drift away from your...
My first job was, I think I was about 14. I got a job with my father's cousin, had a grocery store at Preston and Jefferson called the Crime Grocery Company. And at that time, that was probably one of the biggest grocery stores. And I was going to high school, and what I would do, we'd go there in the evening from about 6 to 9 or 6 to 10. And then on Saturdays, we'd work all day, get there about 7 in the morning to about 11 at night. And get $10 a week for that, which was great. Mm-hmm. But you still go to school, you see. And I worked there maybe perhaps about a year or so. And I must have been 16, I guess. And I was around 16 years old or something around that time, I was finishing Mail High, and I graduated from Mail in the last of January 1919, and I was 20 years old February the 6th. Mm-hmm. And I'd met Hattie a few months before that, and I was in love, mm-hmm. 19 love. Well, we had been going together. Would I skip it? I graduated from Mail when I was 17 years old. January 1923. I got my George W. Marsh mixed up. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. I was 16 years old in January when I graduated. I was 17 in February the 6th, 1923. And I'd met Hattie a few months before that. And so I wanted to go to work, start making some money so we could get married, if she had me. Mm-hmm. And we got married in 1925, November 1925. I was 19 at the time. I was 20, of course, the following February. Usual things in the Ohio, play some football, I pole vaulted on the track team, and some odds and ends, play some basketball. In those days, you didn't have to be very big to play basketball.
Uh-huh.
If you were a guard, as long as you didn't go past the middle of the court, you just stayed there. Of course, uh-huh. The scores would be 18 to 12,
yeah.
Or 22 to 14, but didn't have all the basket throwing. I think I went to work selling cars. My brothers had an automobile place on Third Street. And I was like a messenger.
Uh-huh.
Go to the license bureau, go to the bank, teach people how to drive and stuff.
have a lot, did people buy cars who didn't know how to drive? And
in those days, practically no one did.
Yeah.
When I say no one, generally, or most of the men could drive. A good many men would buy a car for that. In some cases, practically no women. And you'd have to teach the women the wives how to drive. You'd work so hard to try to sell a car in those days. You'd call on people, and you'd call on, and call on, and call on, and call on. You'd go to their houses, you'd take them for rides on Sundays at night time, you'd teach them how to drive, and even then, maybe, perhaps they wouldn't buy a car. Just like you do today, you walk into a showroom, and you pick out a car, and you say, what color is it, what are you giving for my car, and bang, you walk out.
Why was it so much harder to, people just didn't, it wasn't considered a necessity?
Well, I mean, you see, here again, as I told you about the number of people, you didn't have that many people. You didn't have the wherewithal to pay for it. The terms weren't as liberal as they are now. You got a car, you bought it in 12 months. You had 12 months to pay for it. You had to pay a down payment, larger down payment. People weren't making very much. We sold these cars to, they worked hard. Most of the women did not work, but the husbands worked.
Mm-hmm.
So you didn't have the wives' income and the husband's income together that you have today. So those things all had some economical effect.
Mm-hmm.
And they just didn't have it.
Yeah.
You buy an automobile, you pay $10 a week for a new car, which was a big payment. Or you take a car, right before this time, you had the Model T Ford, sold for about $500. I recall even as late as 1935, new Chevrolet, $570, and they were the motor, actually. Going up to '29, Buick could sell for $900-something for a brand new Buick. This gives you an idea of what the price is.
Mm-hmm.
Cadillac maybe $1,800,
$2,000 for 25. What were some of that? That's fascinating that that difference in the car business that you had to solicit so hard to sell a car that you had to take people for drives on Sundays and teach them how to drive. Were there any other things that stand out in your mind, the differences between the car business in the 20s and when you finally got out of it?
Well, the new car, just to give you an idea, if the salesman could sell 50 cars a year, a car a week, he was the greatest salesman in the world. And what would you make on it? You make on $25 or $35 on commission. Maybe if you had any trade, maybe you'd make 50, you get 5% if the car sold for $1,000. Well, you get $50. Now that was tough. You make $50 a week, you were great. Of course, the whole economy was geared different. A person making $50 a week, that was almost top pay. Those who made $75 or $100, they had to be a specialist of some kind to make that kind of money. It's very common people say, well, I'm going to leave my wife $100,000. She never had anything to worry about. She invests the money at 6%. In those days, everything was 6%. You know, there wasn't any 1%, 10%.
Yeah.
Everything was 6%. Everybody paid 6%. She invests the money and get bonds, 6%, get $6,000 a year, she had nothing to worry about. She didn't have a maid, she didn't have a chauffeur. It's true. When I was young, it's true.
Yeah.
I'm going back in the 20s, 21s, 23s, 24s. And then, of course, we popped into the recession there, and starting in 29, a very bad recession. And where Hattie and I went through some very hard times. My brothers fell by the wayside in 29, and in their business, I couldn't get a job anymore. But finally got a job at the Delta Motor Company, had some people. So I mean, you had some connections in the past, like I said. And then in February of 1930, they made me manager of the used car department. Now that was the best job, most best paying job you could get at any automobile place. Now I got $50 a week and 1% on all the used cars that were sold. Now you really had to work on it. I mean, when you were a used car manager in those days, I mean, you did everything. You took care of it. We had a lot on 3rd Street. You had to get the cars in. You had to praise every car coming. Now, people wouldn't come to you. Sales would call you up and say, I want you to go to the 28th and do the deal. Call Mr. So-and-so. Be there at 11 o'clock for the craziest car. Then you say, I want you to be at 1:30. You got to be on 1800 Sherwood Avenue to praise the car, or on Bonnie's Castle, or on River Road, or on Madison Street. And you just go around. You besides have to run your used car place, get the cars in, see that they were reconditioned properly, and then work with the newspapers to put your advertising in there, to run your ads on your cars, and run the papers. That was okay. That was a good job, except they started going bad, too. And first, you know, I was only getting 35. And then finally, I was getting 25, and then 15, and finally, I was on straight commission. And then I'd sell. Road up above a store. I think it was a flower shop there or some other kind of shops. And we had an apartment there right above it. And we paid $20 a month rent when we were able to get to 25. And strange thing that I'm mentioning that now. We were attending a wedding on in St. Agnes Church. Last week, and now Summer Cedar and Hay and I were in the car. We were driving by Newburgh Road, and we happened to slow up there for something. I said, now that's where Hattie and I used to live, just a block from Eastern Park here. And it's still got some stores there. Hattie used to wash our clothes in the bathtub with an old-fashioned scrub board like your grandmother, your great-grandmother used to. We couldn't afford a washing machine. She made her clothes and our little daughter's clothes. And fixed mine up, took my collars when they were torn, cut them off and turned them around. And doctored up my suits where the white threads would go through with some black ink. Just that usual thing. We would go to, Saturday was a big day for shopping, and we'd go to A&P on Saturday. And we would buy a little picnic ham, with Cali ham, for about 48 cents, 6 cents. And a pound of butter for a dime. And eggs were 10 cents a dozen. Coffee, we'd get 3 pounds of 8 o'clock coffee for 27 cents. Hattie and I stopped at Pover's last night and got 2 pounds of some kind of coffee that's Sanka type coffee.
Yeah.
$9. So we got 3 pounds for 27 cents. And we would have baked ham on Sunday. And the next day we'd have a hock of ham with kale greens and parm bread and butter. Now that was good eat, but didn't cost anything.
Yeah.
And then we'd have a ham salad. And we'd have, right down the street on Fifth Street, there used to be a cafeteria called S&M Cafeteria. Now all the cafeterias in town had 35-cent blue plate specials. Now, for 35-cent blue plate special, you'd get a choice of meat, ham, beef, chicken, fish, choice of vegetable, roll, butter, and coffee, tea, or milk, 35 cents. There used to be a news afternoon newspaper here called The Post.
Yeah.
You don't remember
that. I don't remember it. I've seen it, though.
Okay. And The Post used to be an afternoon paper. There used to be, the Courier was a morning paper, and the Herald was a morning paper. And the Courier and Times were together. But the Herald was a separate morning paper, and The Post was a separate afternoon paper. Now, the Post, they used to have an ad in the Post every week with a coupon. And say, this coupon is 35 cents, and you get two dinners, buffet specials, at the S&M Cafeteria on Fifth Street, right across from the old house right there. Mm-hmm. And we would take our little girl, and we get an extra plate, and a glass of milk for her, and we get the two dinners. And we share our two dinners with her, and it costs 40 cents, costs a nickel more for the milk.
Mm-hmm.
And the three of us would have our dinner for 40 cents. And I think another interesting thing is on New Year's Eve, how we celebrated New Year's Eve in this apartment over there on Jager and Newburgh Road. For the drugs, well, first, I got a hold of an old Bosch Super Heterodyne radio. Now, in those days, the radios, outstanding radios, were the Atwater Kent, the Philco, and those kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
Now, those were the radio, big radio sellers. But this Bosch was needed some work, and I monkeyed around with it and got it working. Now, it worked on an automobile storage battery. I was always able to get batteries because I worked for automobile places.
Mm-hmm.
And another thing, too, that I thought was nice, we always had the use of a car.
Yeah.
Because I worked for automobile places. So, on New Year's Eve, in those days, perhaps they do it now, at 11 o'clock, Central Time, it was 12 o'clock in New York City. And New Year's Eve would start being celebrated there, 11 o'clock our time. And you'd hear people at Times Square blowing horns and making noise, and then you'd have Paul Whiteman's orchestra,
mm-hmm.
and Vincent Lopez's orchestra, mm-hmm. and those type of orchestras back in those days. An hour later, we would have Central Zone, and we'd have Coon Sanders out of Chicago and the Goldman Orchestra out of Detroit, and
mm-hmm.
someone down at the New Orleans Blue Room,
mm-hmm.
and so on and so mm-hmm. forth. So we go down to the drugstore and get a quart of vanilla ice cream for 15 cents. And we'd buy a jigsaw puzzle. In those days, jigsaw puzzles were the rage. And you'd buy a fairly nice size one for a nickel. And a dime, you'd get a pretty good one. But for 15 cents, you'd have an enormous, just immense, almost large as this table. Well, Hattie would make some hot fudge out of Hershey's cocoa.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd sit on the floor and turn that radio on. And we listened to that music. And we'd be working a jigsaw puzzle, eating our chocolate sundaes. And the three of us, Hattie and I and a little bit of that. And no one could have more fun than me. That was great. And you know, a lot of people say, well, did you resent this? Or were you ambitious? I said, no. It never entered our mind, except that the Lord put us on this earth just to do what we were doing. And we were contented.
Mm-hmm.
And we were contented. Hattie had a couple operations. We had hard times, but we were contented. We felt like this was our lot in life. And we never complained. We didn't see any reason to complain.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't know any better. In May the 1st, 1933, the Delhi Motor Company I worked for, went out of business. Went all over town, I couldn't find a job. Our folks didn't have any money, and we couldn't get any money, but we were able to get $20 here and $50 here, and I think we got about $300 or $400 together. And we went in the used car business.
Mm-hmm.
At Brook and Broadway. There was a building there, and we had to pay $100 a month rent to get into the building, on a month-to-month lease. And we paid $100 for insurance policy, liability insurance policy, in case I ran over something or some person or somebody, or hurt someone, because I didn't have anything to pay him with. And some other odds and ends, we got hold of a bridge table with a broken leg, and we wired that up, and a kitchen chair, and that was our office furniture. Hattie and I and our little girl were there every day, every night, every Sunday. And when we sold the car and we'd make $50, well, then we could use that money to buy another car or buy two cars. We didn't spend it. We still lived the same way. We still mm-hmm. lived over the grocery store in the We still went to the S&M cafeteria. We still had our whatever we did the same way. We didn't buy any clothes. We just didn't think we could. And we were still contented. And then gradually we started doing a little better. I never forget, I used to say to someone, "You give me, I'll sign up for $20 a week the rest of my life if you'll guarantee to pay me back."
Mm-hmm.
And if someone would say to me, "Sam," he probably read that somewhere. Like that. This is so true. One of these days you're going to be worth $500. Well, boy, I just couldn't believe it. But then all of a sudden, well, we did start doing better. And we moved into a duplex on Rockledge Avenue, and at this time we paid $35 a month. But this is real living. This was a nice apartment, nice duplex. Nice little neighborhood, dead end street, so a little girl could play. And we started doing better, and better, and better, and better. And then we still would put all our money back in cars. Now this doesn't mean that we didn't buy some clothes every once in a while then, because we could afford it by that time. Then we got this, we had a building in Jackson Broadway that we moved out of and went to right across the Sears Roebuck. There was a lot there that we got. And we started doing much better there. And then we became fairly well off for us, in this case, especially. And we kept buying more and more cars. And I'd always buy cars in November, December, because this is when the dealers would be loaded up with cars and they couldn't sell them. And you could buy them very cheap. I'd even go to Chicago, Indianapolis, and snow on it. And they'd love to get rid of them. You find, in February, you try to buy those same cars, you'd pay $100 more for them. And the time March or April came around, you'd pay $200 or $300 more for them. In those days, cars were a low price. $200 or $300 on a car then was a lot of money. So that worked real well for us all the time. The war was declared in December of 41, and nothing was doing for 4 or 5 months because the world was at a standstill. Then all of a sudden people realized that there weren't going to be any more cars. New car factories were being turned into making cannons, planes, parts for things. So all the factories were making war material. So we had an enormous amount of cars. That's very, very lucky. Just had an enormous amount of cars. And it was just a question of how much money we could make. I'd say from July 42 on, I never made less than $10,000 a month the rest of my life.
There's a little bit of astonishment in my face. From July 1942.
I've never made less than $10,000 a month.
And you attribute that, at least partially, that's because of the shortage of World War II.
Well, that too, but don't forget what I had didn't last. I had to keep buying cars. Yeah. And as I told you before, I'm not an angel, but Hattie and I were thankful for what we had. And we never paid over ceiling for a car. You had ceilings over.
Uh-huh.
I never violated any regulations. Never paid over ceiling, never sold one for over ceiling. If people would offer me all sorts of money, I would not do it.
Do you have a philosophy of business?
Well, partly what I just said right there. During the OPA, we never had any violations. We told the OPA people when they started, look, if anyone comes in there, if they're not satisfied, anything they bought from us, tell them to bring it back, we'll give them their money back.
Mm-hmm.
Because if they were just pills, you know, you couldn't please them, why, you take that car and sell it to somebody else. Mm-hmm. And if it was a lemon, I didn't want them to have it. Mm-hmm. I'd take it and take it out to auction and get rid of it. When I was in the used car business, I don't know how it is now, but it was considered a very low, ugly type of business. People ridiculed the used car business. I guess they considered it about one grade above the pawnbroker, or the pawnbroker one grade above the used car dealer. I'm not sure which order it came. But strangely enough, I was never sued in my life, and I never sued anybody else when I was in the used car business. No one ever sued me. I never sued anyone else.
You have satisfied customers.
I had satisfied customers. Repeat business all the time.
Yeah.
And it wasn't difficult. I just don't understand why a lot of others. We had enough of a volume that we could do that. But if I sold you a car, if it was real linen, I wouldn't want you to have it. I'd take it out and let somebody at the auction, because some of those fellows didn't care what they did. I would normally buy one, but sometimes you couldn't help yourself, or you take one and trade or something. But if you were just a chronic complainer, and you would complain about this, and we try to fix it up for you, and we might say, well, we could give you a different car, give you money back. But we'd sell somebody else, and the next person, we used to watch that, the next person bought your car, said it was the greatest car in the world. Never had a bit of trouble with it. If there's any philosophy, I guess that, yeah, we try to run the bank that way. We go out of our way to satisfy people. And this is why we put our emphasis on where people come first.
Yeah.
And we really mean that. We've always been recognized as a little man's bank. You might be interested in, and I'm surprised you hadn't asked me yet, is how'd you get into the bank?
Yeah. Go ahead.
Okay. We made a lot of money in the used car business. And we had an opportunity to buy some stock in the Royal Bank, 4th and Morgan. Now, we had no idea of ever getting into the banking business. That never entered my mind. And by the way, by that time, I had my brother with me as a partner.
Yeah.
And we bought it for investment because we paid $390,000 for 44% block in it. And only because it was a good investment. We were put on the board, of course, but we had no interest in it as far as running it or having it. But because other people were running it. We had an opportunity a few years after that to buy some more of the stock. One of the main officers sold his stock and got out of the bank. And he was out of the bank and he wanted to sell his stock to the brokers here. So we bought an additional 8% on the market. I don't remember what we paid for that, but I think we paid almost as much for that as we did the 44%. But here we own 42% of the stock of the Royal Bank. Now, here again with the idea of not... We still had an automobile business, which was quite lucrative, with no idea of going to... See, we had a lot of places here. The place where you're sitting used to be a big used car lot.
Right.
We always had great big places, one at Sears, one over here. We must have had, with my other brother and ourselves, we must have had about 12 of them. And we were the biggest, counting together, we were the largest in the United States. We were the biggest used car in the United States. I don't think anybody was as large as we were in one city. Some of them maybe had branches in cities or something like that. I think we were the largest. So we had never dreamt about going into the bank, but as things progressed, I was talked into going into the bank. And I fought it. I did. I fought it very vigorously because I didn't want that responsibility. When I came back from, vacation in March of '56, my brother and my son-in-law, Stan and Yarmouth, said to me, "We've been thinking while you're going. We think you ought to go to the bank." And I said, "Well, I would touch it with a 10-foot pole." And they said, "Why?" I said, "I don't want that aggravation." I says, "I'm 50 years old, I'm a millionaire, why should I fool with it?" And he said, "Well, what do you think to do about the used car business? We had started to retrench a little bit, cutting down some of our places." And I said, "Well, I think we ought to increase, we had a finance company." I said, "I think we ought to build up our finance company, not only to take our business, but to take a lot of other dealers' businesses." And we were planning on that, but then everybody started talking to me and working on me. So in April, I went over to the bank. And I went in as a vice president until the the first year when we had our annual meeting, why was not the president? So a lot of people wondered how this used car guy could be president of the bank. What's he know about banking? And I can understand that. But all my life, I was a nut when it comes to figures. I love figures, and I love to study taxes. I knew quite a bit about income taxes, inheritance taxes, estate taxes, all that. And the laws, the rules. I used to love to look at a financial statement and try to tear it apart. I guess I still do that. At least sometimes when I turn a loan down, I think some of the people think I tore it apart too much. Mm-hmm. But in the used car business, the old finance company, why, everything could happen to consumer, could happen by experience. So I knew more about consumer law than almost anybody. Because that's all we ever did. Yeah. It was all consumer law. In fact, lawyers used to call me up from time to time. So rather than look up the law, would you tell me what happens in that? We would tell them. So this was a natural for me because the bank predominantly was a consumer credit bank. Mm-hmm. It was all little people. It was all financed automobiles, financed television sets. I mean, not television sets. Appliances, FHA loans, all monthly payment type deals, which was right up our alley.
Yeah.
So that worked out fine for me. Of course, once I got in there as president in January 1957, I started putting the emphasis on commercial banking. Don't get me wrong now, we still do a good goodly amount of consumer credit, but we also do them both. We do commercial, like all the banks do today. Our ratio might be a little higher on one than theirs because they're starting on one end and we're starting on the other. It was difficult. If I could have taken the bank if it's just starting a new bank, then I could have done a lot better. But I had a difficult time. The bank did not have, the Royal Bank didn't have the kind of reputation that it should have had. And it took a lot to overcome that stigma, if you want to call it that, of being more like a high-class loan company joint or something like that. But I'm happy to say that we did develop because the first day I stepped in, I got everybody together and I said, as long as I'm behind this desk, we're going to do everything according to the way we're supposed to do. We're going to treat everybody nice. We're going to be friendly. And we're going to take care of people and see that everybody gets a fair deal. And if anybody doesn't do that, out they go. And we had some good men on our board of directors, Milton Trolls and Watson Dabney, some people like that. Were very good, and that's what they wanted too. So I didn't have any problem there. Yeah. So we had a nice group, a nice relationship, and we grew rather rapidly after a hard time. After I was president a few months, in those days, the FDIC, I believe it was, the FDIC insured your deposits up to $10,000. Now it's up to 40.
Mm-hmm.
And the banks in town only paid on savings accounts, paid 1% on savings, up to $2,500. Anything over that, they did not pay you any interest.
Right.
So if you had $10,000 in the savings account, you got 0.25%.
Uh-huh.
And the big companies, they didn't worry with that at all. It was too small. So I sent our two vice presidents, John Speaker and Watson and Ed Sturgeon, around all the big companies in town, saying, well, look, we have three branches, and we're little man's branch, a bank. We take care of your customers. We try to service them. We make loans to them so they can have things. Good things, and we'd like a courtesy account of $10,000, which will be insured by the FDIC. All over the city level, all the big companies. You know how much money we got? Zero, not 10 cents, zero. So you see, we really had to lift ourselves up by our bootstraps. This is what we did.
And you did that, how did you do that? Through
Just plugging, mm-hmm. working hard, and just keep trying to get more deposits, some friends, some organizations, mm-hmm. and so forth.
How much time do you have?
Steve's going to pick me up at 10 minutes to 12, about 15 minutes.
Okay. You talked before we started to record, you talked some about the, I guess you could say, the different elements in the Jewish community in Louisville, and about how you felt like that, although you had served with many Jewish agencies, how you felt like that you could better serve them by serving with groups, other civic groups, non-Jewish groups, as a sort of representative, if you will.
Yes,
can you talk
to them
about that?
Yeah, I think that's pretty much, I think you're referring to what I said, that that I had originally started by being involved with mostly Jewish activities.
Mm-hmm.
In our church, for example, Temple Abbot Israel, I was president of the men's club in 1945. Then 2 or 3 years later, I went on the board of trustees, and then I became secretary for 3 years and a vice president for a year. Then I became president in 1945. I was president in 45 and 46. I was president when Dr. Rao died. I don't know if you've ever heard of Dr.
Mm-hmm.
Rao. Probably one of the most beloved men locals ever have. And one of my very dearest friends, who died in February of 56. And that was a terrible blow for me. No, he didn't die in 56. Forget that. He died in 57. He died in 57, I'm sorry. Because I'll never forget when I was to be president of the bank for the annual meeting.
Mm-hmm.
I called him up and said, Dr. Ron, I said, I'd like to see you for a few minutes. I'm digressing from what you asked
mm-hmm.
me of. He said, well, can you come over and I'll study about 4 o'clock? And I did. And I said, tomorrow I'm to be president of the Bank of Louisville, and I wonder if you would say a prayer for me. And he took me in the sanctuary, and he blessed me and said a prayer for me. He died a month and a half after that. It was a terrible shock for me. But I I was on the YMHA board back in the old days, and even at the Jewish Community Center for a while. On United Jewish campaigns, quite a few Jewish activities. I found myself being asked more and more I was invited to be on more civic groups, and I felt like after studying for a while that I could contribute a lot more. To my cohorts or my fellow religionists,
mm-hmm.
whatever word you want to use that, helping out on some of the boards where they didn't have the Jewish representation.
Right.
It seemed like that the United Jewish Campaign, the Jewish Community Center, and the temples and all, they have already had good Jewish people working there,
mm-hmm.
men and women
mm-hmm.
working. So as long as they had good, hard-working, outstanding leaders, Jewish leaders, they didn't need me. And I felt like I could perhaps maybe get more of exposure by putting some emphasis on organizations where they perhaps were not represented by Jewish persons.
Right.
So this is what I was trying to bring out before. And now this doesn't mean, now most of the organizations that I'm on do have some Jewish members,
mm-hmm.
like the Goodwill Industries or the Salvation Army and all the other
mm-hmm.
things I'm on. The various boards, I mean, too numerous to mention at this time.
Maybe one final question before you go to lunch, and maybe this might be an unfair question. But it seems like to me that it would be an accurate characterization to say that that you were a poor boy who never forgot your origins. You made a financial success out of yourself, and you're now an influential member of the community. And I guess my question is, Well, you've been involved in downtown development, community affairs. I guess my question is, finally, who runs Louisville? As far as people like yourself who pull themselves up by their bootstraps, you might say, or the families who've been around for a while. And,
actually, your question is maybe two or threefold there.
Yeah.
I'd say that you asked me, I think, or you indicated I appear to be the same now as if I would have been years ago. And that's true. I never have changed. In other words, I'm never ashamed to be with someone that I was with years ago.
Yeah.
In fact, I welcome them. I love to see them. But I go out of my way to try to get into it. No, I've never changed. I've never felt like that I was any different, any better now than I was then, because I'm not.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not. I feel the same. I've been lucky. We've been lucky after a lot of hard times. I try to, as you know, I'm on University level board. I'm on Bellarmine College board. I'm certainly not Catholic. Yeah. At the present time, I'm general chairman of the campaign for the Ursuline Sisters,
mm-hmm.
for their new structure out there that they are. So you probably do know that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm on the advisory committee of the campaign for the Baptist Seminary for their new drive. I'm on it does not make any difference to me who they are or what they are.
Mm-hmm.
They can, any religion they are, whether black, whether white. I've been on secret boards to help minority, especially the black people in the West End for years. And we try to help. This has been my philosophy of life. Now, getting back to who runs Louisville,
yeah.
It's a different thing entirely.
Yeah.
I say this with no no bitterness. I say this not to hurt anybody,
mm-hmm.
but I think Louisville is being run by courage around the times. And he's a very dear friend of mine, senior engineer.
Mm-hmm.
So is the Dolly Bank. Now I'd say probably First National up there pretty good. The Citizens Bank for years and years. I think the Maury Johnson's been a very dominant force in the past 7-8 years. You do have to be a dominant, you normally are a dominating force. So I guess you have to include the mayor.
Mm-hmm.
However, I think his wife, Kathy, and Edie Bingham have participated quite a bit in civic affairs. Now, you're talking about leaders and dominating people now. They dominate the business, and this is what I'm trying to bring out. This doesn't mean that they're doing anything that they shouldn't be doing.
Right.
Okay? The usual group, you want name calling, Gordon Davidson, Wilson White's office, Andy Wilson. That's an owner from Lowell Gas and Electric Company, although he has kind of stayed out of things for the past few years. I would say the normal thing that you referred to, and we always used to refer to him as a River Road crowd, but so many of us live around that way today, so you can't very well include all of it in one cabin anymore, because so many people move along the way. Now, these people are outstanding leaders and probably deserve to be the leaders. Sometimes they might, their decisions may not be what we might want them to be, but still, they're good leaders. Whatever they do, they try to do, in their opinion, they try to do what they think is best for the community.
Mm-hmm.
I hope they just don't get the situation, but I think best is always good.
Yeah.
What they say, but like General Motors wants to speak for the nation or something like that. I hope they don't get that attitude. So far, I think they haven't reached that. And they are a good group of people. And I would imagine if you go, Al Sheeter has been a tremendous man to see it there. Most of the things he's done is been terrible, terrible dogs. And this is part, one of the differences that I referred to. It seems like when someone else wants something in this community, like the Hyatt House or the Sealback Hotel, Roy Johnson and the mayor and all that group and the local central area and the little bit of, and I'm on their boards, I'm on all these boards now. So, and I tell them that. They got anything they can for them. Lend them all the money, arrange the money. Anytime Al Sheeter wants something, he never asked for any money. But they try like the devil to keep him from doing it. They did that for the Gold House. They've done that for the Six and Main deal. They've done it with, in fact, every time he wants, now he's, what he's trying to do right now, they've been delaying it and making it very difficult for him instead of going out and trying to help him and encourage him, because it is good for the community. But they'll come in with arguments where they say it's not good for the community. Like I say, they have a right to their opinion. So you say, who are the leaders? I think probably Al Sheeter's done more for this community than any one person since Brandon Brown. So that's excluding the newspaper, because national newspapers have the power, the media.
Well, I certainly enjoyed talking to you.
I can enjoy talking to you.
I don't want to keep you from your lunch.
Yeah. Is there anything? Well, this is about it. I think if you want to, if you think of something,